Music by Karol Szymanowski, the first of his three Basques, Opus 34. And that comes from Christian Zimmermann's 2023 Gramophone Award-winning DG album of the Polish composer's piano music. I'm James Jolly and welcome to this Gramophone podcast. Christian Zimmermann came to London last October to collect the award, his seventh, and I caught up with him on the morning of the ceremony.
In a few hours' time, I'm going to be presenting you with the Piano Award for the Szymanowski album. But tell me the story of the recording, because it contains recordings from two sessions, quite a long way apart.
1972, where I actually learned them and played them for the first time. And I remember the first concerts in London in the 70s, where I played Szymanowski. And
I mean, back then, it must have been almost unheard music to most people.
Yes. And there was a young student, I mean a student, he's 1 year older than me, but who came backstage fascinated with this music and said, look, it's absolutely great. I also know some of his orchestra pieces. The student was Simon Rattle. Today he's an expert of this music. Maybe the best recording of Szymanowski ever made are made by Simon's. And I have enormous gratitude to Britain and the British media for supporting Szymanowski's music, maybe more than to the Polish media. It's amazing how much this country did for this composer.
It's funny, we have these sort of strange things, like Berlioz.
Yeah. You know, but you did rector, Górecki.
Yes.
You know, Górecki wrote this famous symphony when I was studying with him.
Yes.
He was my rector and signed my diploma, actually.
Oh, talking of Szymanowski, do you ever play the Sinfonia Concertante, the fourth symphony?
No, Simon is bugging me for 30 years now to learn this piece. Maybe in the next life,
So the recording that we're honouring tonight, a lot of it was recorded in the mid-90s, and then you were, as it were, you topped it up a couple of...
I didn't continue in the 90s, and the tragic part is that all the retakes from the masks got lost or damaged by the company. The moment the company moved from Hanover to London, they took only the most important tapes. And it was in the middle of 2012 or 15. So the tapes were already 25 years old and they thought, well, the guy will never finish the record. So they destroyed it. There were 72 retakes for the masks, making them better. Nevertheless, I decided to put it out anyway, because I think it's a sensational piece, and I'm sure some younger pianist will do it better. Szymanowski is not one person, we have to say. His mazurkas are from a completely different period, and he's a completely different composer. His early pieces are maybe the most honest, and you know, after the variations, he actually tried to commit suicide. Maybe that's where this March Funèbre comes from. We can only speculate what the reason was, but I can imagine that for him, he became conscious how difficult this life would be for him, seeing Oscar Wilde running away for the same reasons from England to France. It was a very, very difficult time for you know, a man like this. That's my speculation on it, of course. Later, the period of fascination with Ravel, impressionistic music. He was never really impressionistic, but his masks are the answer of Gaspard de la Nuit. Problem with this music is also that he had enormously big hands. So it's, for a normal pianist like me, it's a transcendental difficulty, technical difficulty to just master these pieces, to play them through. So I'm not playing them often in a concert. Funny enough, I play them in this 51st season in my life. Starting now, I just played them day before yesterday in Schaffhausen in Switzerland, and I'm doing them on a tour in Japan and in Korea.
Do you know, I think the first time I ever heard a note of Szymanowski's music was when you released that album of the Franck Violin Sonata with Kaya Dantrowska. And I think that was my first encounter with the music. Yeah. And I mean, it was my first recording the Franck Sonata. Uh-huh. I think it still remains one of my favourites. But I remember being absolutely overwhelmed by the sound world of the myths.
Yeah. You know, that was the trick. We put the Franck, people bought the record because of the Franck and ended up with the Szymanowski. And many people came back and said, well, you know, I bought this record with a Franck Sonata, but the Szymanowski is fantastic music. Mm. And many people turned to this composer. I did it quite consciously. And I'm sorry for that. I have to beg for forgiveness.
Well, I think a lot of us all are these people thankful,
who,
actually.
Who were tricked into the Szymanowski. But I wanted to do something for him, and I was absolutely fascinated with his music, orchestral music, and you know, chamber and songs. Opus 5 is this fantastic cycle of songs. So it's it's a composer, certainly a composer worth to.
And presumably nowadays it's much easier to persuade concert promoters to accept Szymanowski on a program.
And I'm also, I have to say, I'm grateful to my former manager, Jasper Parrott, who was one of the first having courage to book it in the recital program, where other European managers were actually too scared to do that.
Tell me about, I mean, chamber music in your life. I mean, it's sort of, it's always popped up every so often. Is it something you find a rewarding thing to do, to perform, you know, intimately, actually, with two or three friends?
You know, I'm coming from chamber music. My father was a musician, and because shortly after the war, making a living as a musician was completely impossible, he would come back from the factory with two or three victims like him, and they would start playing.
What did he play?
He played piano. And they would be in a door, you know, before undressing, they already tuned the instrument, started to play. And in the beginning, I was turning pages. Later, I got a little trumpet with a keyboard where I could mimic few notes. From these few notes, later became a melody, and about 2 years later, I could actually read in any key, any score which they were putting before my nose. So that was a fantastic experience. It went on for almost 12 years. Later, in the late 60s, these people left Poland, three of them left Poland, one to Sweden, one to Israel, one to Germany, and this quartet was destroyed. But I was always missing chamber music, and from the very first day, I was also working in that field. It's not easy. I just finished a tour with my quartet, where we played, you know, Brahms quartets, and planning the next tour in next spring. But it's the most rewarding way of making music.
I noticed you performed the Brahms second and third at Lucerne.
Yeah.
So have you just been doing the two quartets?
You've not yes, been, two and three. Yeah.
And why did you choose two and three particularly? I mean, you know, is it that one is the one that everybody plays?
Yeah, it's the most known for some reason. I don't know. My favorite is three.
Yeah.
But why do you choose a piece of music? It's a little bit like in this joke with the two ties which the grandmother gave to the child, and he immediately wears one of them, comes down very proud, and the grandmother says, oh, don't you like the other one?
Fair enough.
It's you really don't know what you will like next year, and I'm putting the programs very late. You know, now I'm retired, so I stopped planning. My calendar for 24 is empty, and it's a wonderful feeling because always something comes up.
I was going to say, will say, why didn't you come and play? And you think, yeah, I think I will.
Yes, I'm not planning any longer than 3-4 months ahead. And a part of chamber music, I'm conducting quite a lot now. Mm-hmm. I will build an ensemble in Bangkok this year. I'll conduct in Manila and so on. So I conducted last year in Singapore. It's something I'm doing since 1977, and working with an orchestra is very, very interesting. And there's so much repertoire which is not really recorded deeply. You know, orchestras always have these two rehearsals, and you always hear the same mid-Atlantic performance of this piece. And when one gets deeper, suddenly things which are coming out of an accompaniment of a Chopin concerto is shocking for the people. And that can be done with any piece. We just have to work on it.
Do you want to create an ensemble with a particular sound? I mean, do you want to get back to a kind of a more...
Everything. I mean, you need a particular sound for every piece, and you need, of course, a particular way of playing of every piece. So I want to go much deeper than the regular orchestras doing in two or four rehearsals. That's not easy. And you have to really go to orchestras which are very motivated. You can't find it in middle of Europe because their way of working is given and you practically can't move anything. But you have very motivated people in Asia. You have young people who I would create an orchestra of 98 people now for a big symphony with an ensemble which is given of about 50 people. So I will combine splash people from school and a regular orchestra, have 8 rehearsals and regular rehearsals within groups and so on. Mm. So it's a very interesting work for me.
Yes, because I am getting the feeling sort of increasingly that when a conductor takes an orchestra that traditionally had a very distinctive sound, rather than just say, I want to create this kind
in a,
of...
In the past, it was like this.
Yeah, I mean,
You could distinguish an orchestra 40, 50 years ago when I started to collect records. It took you 10 seconds to say, oh, this is Boston, this is the brass of Chicago, this is the strings of Concertgebouw of Vienna. You had this variety. Now the globalization and especially internet and especially YouTube sort of leveled everything down. We have this so-called best performance of the piece and everybody is trying to mimic that. It's funny, in a recital just 2 days ago, I played pieces from 1903. Pieces of Rachmaninoff, pieces of Debussy, and pieces of Szymanowski. And this is not the biggest spectrum of this time, but you notice how different composers were composing in this period, maybe the most interesting period for music. You have, you know, Prokofiev, Shostakovich, Rachmaninoff. In one country, you have Respighi, you have Schoenberg, Webern in another part of the world, you have Copland. And I mean, unbelievable variety.
And presumably, but back then, there would have been a bigger variety of pianos they were playing on.
Yes, also, yeah. Steinway domination came after the war, mostly because Vienna was occupied by the Russians until 55, and all the other companies were around Vienna, Bösendorfer and so on. So Steinway had these 10 years where it used the time to create a monopoly. And that has good and bad sides. Steinway is a very good piano. I'm also using a Steinway. But of course, having just one standard is rather difficult.
Have you ever been tempted to try playing on a Pleyel or, you know?
Yes, I do. Mm. Yes, I do. But, it's a very complicated subject. You know, we also changed the addressee of the music. We also use much bigger concert halls now. If you imagine, Schubert wrote for very small spaces, Chopin too. Chopin was known from that the ladies after the concert said, you know, we were in a concert of Frederick, but he played so soft, we hardly could hear anything. Imagine a small salon with you know, 5-6 rows where people couldn't hear him. How this guy would have sounded in a Hollywood Bowl today. And I played recitals in a Hollywood Bowl with Schubert. So it's a complete nonsense. The whole ambience, everything changed.
We've all been through this extraordinary, you know, this global phenomenon, the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I mean, did that sort of change your attitudes to the way you work?
I spent 5 weeks sleeping in a car here in London so that I can record the Beethoven concertos with Simon and the London Symphony. That was the maybe most crazy experience of my life. But I had the choice to sit in a hotel and be in the quarantine for 2 weeks without the piano, and then come out and immediately on the next day, without having practiced for 2 weeks, make a recording for Deutsche Grammophon, or to decide to hire a big hangar, put my pianos and all the keyboards in, put my car and a sleeping possibility in, of the van inside, and just sleep in a car for 5 weeks in a very cold place. So that was really a great experience for me, and working with an orchestra which was 1.5 meter apart, you know, sound, that's physics. The sound has a certain speed. When it comes back from the last oboe, which is 17 meters from me, we will be always late. So we had to solve problems with Simon, which we never thought that we'll be confronted with. And this recording is maybe my greatest success of my life, because we were faced with impossible, completely impossible conditions, and we made it work. And then when the whole concerts were supposed to happen, we had to have 9 concerts in 2 days, playing both in one day 4 concertos, in the other day 5 concertos. The night before, Mr. Johnson decided to close England, and within 4 hours I had to run away with all my keyboards and pianos, so that I took the last train at 23:55, escaping from England on the 16th of December, few minutes before the country was totally closed.
And how important are recordings to you in your career? Because if you look through your catalogue, I mean, it's a big catalogue, and it's all regularly spaced. Sometimes there's a bit of a longer gap.
No, it's not regularly spaced. For 27 years, I didn't record anything. I hated the digital technique. I hated the clarity of the sound, this shifting of importance from music to sound. Mm-hmm. You know, music is not sound. We're using sounds, but clarity of the sound. More clarity doesn't mean more music. I would say in the contrary. Music is time. Music is emotion in time. And what I'm trying to do in the concerts is to reconstruct the reason why the composer wrote the pieces. The reason which made him write it down. Schubert was obsessed, you know, he couldn't sleep at night, he switched on his candle and he was writing at 2 o'clock at night because he had to. So this fix on the sound was for me a great obstacle.
Did you enjoy the process more when we were back in analog days where it was going onto tape?
Any confrontation with, you know, holding this in a can was for me wrong, okay. Always. Music is something living and something which only can be created in lifetime. So a record is a nice storage, but this is not art.
Because, I mean, you made a lot of recordings with Bernstein. I mean, those would have all been live rather than studios.
Live. Yeah, they were all live. It's not written on the records, but they were actually live. Yeah.
Was that preferable to just going into a sterile
studio? Yes and no,
studio?
Because in a concert hall you play either for the microphone or for the people, depending what the microphone is. But sometimes you cannot do both. So some live recordings didn't work. The first D minor concerto was a hell for me, because I had the choice for whom to play. I took this experience for the next year, and the B flat was much better because I already knew how to deal with this problem. But it was a gigantic problem. When digital technique emerged, we were suddenly faced with completely new challenges, and sound producers were fascinated with the clarity. We hated it because it shifted our work into the craftsmanship part rather more than into the musical part. And the moment you shift it so much, you kill the pieces. When you played it 1,000 times, it cannot be fresh anymore. And that's what digital technique made with us, that we had to practice on the technical part much, much more than before.
And for this Brahms piano quartet's recording, have you done that live again, or did you? Is it a studio setup?
Well, you know, playing with an orchestra has always this live factor in it, because you have many people, you play for each other, you exchange ideas, you move themes from one instrument to the other. So it has some of the live factors, whether there is audience or not. But we also made live recordings, yeah. And we're learning from these live recordings what we are doing when we start to fly in a concert, when we take off.
And would that be the way in future you would prefer to record, just catch it live, maybe two concerts?
I don't know. It depends from the pieces. It's sometimes I want to be quietly in the studio and nibble on the material. Sometimes it's going just warm in a concert in one take, and that's it. I remember when I recorded the Liszt sonata, for about 7 days, I was recording, and there was no one note I liked. And then the night before, the sound producer already dismantled some of the material, and they said, okay, we are not getting it. There's no way we can record it in one night, that what we didn't do in 7 days. And there was a terrible storm outside. It was raining, it was gloomy, it was, you know, thunderstorm. And I suddenly felt, that's it, today is the day. And I played the sonata 5 times. And this is the 4th time it's on the record, with some retakes taken from other versions, but it's actually one shot.
And are you a pianist who gets very involved in the editing process? I mean, some just sort of basically hand it over to the producer and it comes back finished. I mean, do you...
I get, because I know when I start a phrase this way, I wouldn't end it like this. So I hear every cut and it disturbs me. And the sound producer said, yes, but how can you hear? I mean, there's inaudible. I said, yeah, I know, but I don't hear the cut itself, but I know that when I start a phrase like this, I will never end it like that. And it's not about clean notes. It's about the logic of the flow of the music, the logic of the narration. And that's what I'm looking in the editing process. It's not so much about, you know, getting the notes right. Today, it doesn't really interest me so much.
So tell me a little bit more about your conducting, because I mean, you've worked alongside some of the most spectacular conductors of our time. So you've kind of learnt the craft with some very, very fine examples.
I was learning conducting for about 30 years. And indeed, I had fantastic people to work with, and from each of them I learned something. In fact, I made a list now for this 50th season, which I wanted to publish. It's 139 names of conductors,
wow.
Literally everybody who was around in the last 50 years.
But I mean, you know, even if I just came up with a list of great conductors from the, you know, my lifetime, most of them you work with, you know, Bernstein, Karajan, Böhm, Ozawa, Giulini, I mean, you know, on and on.
Yes, I was really lucky. It was interesting to see in which different way each conductor solved problems. And sometimes completely opposite solutions, but it worked. Each time it worked in itself. So I'm very, very grateful to Bernstein, of course, in the first place, but also Kondrashin, Karajan, and Mazel, Boulez. These were the people who had learned the technique, Boulez's phenomenal technique of conducting and of analysis of the work. But also Barshai, who was a teacher and my neighbor in Switzerland.
Amazing.
So Barshai always tried to animate me and said, Krisztiánczyk, you have to conduct, you have to conduct. You have a hands of a conductor. You must be joking.
No, Barshai was one of the conductors I grew up with, because he was, yeah. He had the ball.
His wife was the teacher.
All right.
She taught many of the most important Russian conductors.
That's kind of unusual, a woman teaching men to conduct.
No, she was phenomenal. She was fabulous. So it was luck, actually, but also my fascination in orchestra music, because I treat the piano also like an orchestra. It's the most orchestra-like instrument in music. We'll be right back.
part of the finale of Beethoven's first piano concerto. It was played by Christian Zimmermann with the London Symphony Orchestra and Sir Simon Rattle, part of a cycle of five concertos that they recorded under socially distant circumstances in a brief break in lockdown. And all of Christian Zimmermann's recordings are made for Deutsche Grammophon. Grammophon podcasts are free, but if you enjoy them, then a really great way to support our work is to take out a subscription to Grammophon magazine. Over 13 issues a year, we bring you hundreds of reviews by our expert critics, as well as in-depth articles about the latest classical music releases and the most exciting musicians of the day. And if you head over to gramophone.co.uk/subscribe and enter the code PODCAST20 in the checkout, you can even get a 20% discount off any subscription package. We really value your support. And consider leaving a review or rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And do look out for another Gramophone podcast very soon.